This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at DOUCETSurvey.com. That's DoucetteSurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at NECU.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With spring just 2 days away, the promises we made to ourselves back on January 1st may feel like a vague memory. Perhaps you resolved to stop eating sugar, exercise more, or drink a little less. So what did you do? Shrug your shoulders and reach for another cupcake? Log on to veganlife.com? Head for the bookstore to find somebody, anybody, who could guide you to be fitter, happier, and more radiant. The writer Jessica Lamb set out to explore the $11 billion industry of self-improvement books, seminars, and coaching to figure out why people follow them so devoutly, if they work, and what happens when they don't. We spoke to her when her memoir, Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture, was first released. It's now available in paperback. So bring us back to the origins of self-help. You found records back in ancient Egypt, but it is a particularly American fixation. So help us understand that history.
Well, I did find a book of advice from father to son in ancient Egypt. And then I was trying to think outside of the box a little bit and not look at things that were prototypes for self-help. So not necessarily self-help books. So I looked at some ancient Greek texts like Marcus Aurelius, which you mentioned. I looked at parts of the Bible, like Proverbs, which gives us advice on how to live. There were etiquette books in the 1600s and 1700s, which I also consider to be prototypes for self-help books. And then self-help as we know it today really took off in the mid-19th century in England, actually. A man named Samuel Smiles wrote a book called Self-Help, which was basically a collection of inspirational stories similar to today's Chicken Soup for the Soul.
Well, we learn more about that Chicken Soup for the Soul franchise and its extremely, extremely successful author when you attend a conference that he gives. He has a kind of formula for how things are successful, and there is a kind of reliance on formula in a lot of self-help books, the inspirational story being one element, and this kind of imperative. You must do things this way. What are some examples of how that works on people?
Well, this was just taken from my own experience at this conference that I went to, where a self-help writer was teaching other self-help writers how to write self-help books. And he just kept telling us what to do, you know, do this, do that, even down to things that didn't really have to do with self-help, things about that we were given these binders with all these instructions and where to go. And I started to feel really comfortable and relaxed, and it really reminded me of being a child, which was kind of the last time that I'd had that experience of somebody really micromanaging my every move. And I started to wonder if that was kind of the appeal of self-help, is that you're sort of returned to this childhood-like state where the rules are very clear and you just understand what you're supposed to do. I think that it causes a lot of anxiety being a grown-up and not always knowing what to do in every situation.
You attended a workshop by one of the authors of the book, The Rules. Now, this was a 1995 book first on how to land a husband. Now it's pretty much a full-blown franchise with a pretty rigid set of absolutes. I'd love you to pick it up from there. What's their formula and what's the success story for someone who follows the rules?
Well, their formula is very similar to what we would call playing hard to get. It involves pretending not to be interested, and it's essentially like a manipulation of the other person where you present yourself as somebody who's distant and aloof, and you kind of cause the other person to, they call it the male is the hunter biologically. So you cause men to sort of hunt you, I suppose, like some sort of animal in the woods, and that will lead to marriage is their supposition. You know, and it may have worked for many people. In this particular instance where I went to the workshop, a woman named Betsy came, and she told a story of how she used the rules. And she said, "I'm the ultimate rules girl because I got married twice in 1 year." And
wow.
I was really surprised by that because I thought, that wait, that doesn't sound right. Twice in 1 year. That means you got divorced. That doesn't seem like a success story.
Well, one of the suggestions or one of the rules for the rules is to make sure that all of your self-help books are out of sight if a man is coming over. So it seems like it's promoting a kind of shame at being the kind of person who would need the program that they are selling.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you just want to seem like this completely imperturbable, perfect person, which none of us are. And it seems like, you know, one flaw in that is that at some point you're going to relax and then you're going to reveal your true self. And that might be somebody who likes self-help books or, you know, does any number of potentially undesirable things. And, you know, to me, it seems better to get that stuff out front right in the beginning as opposed to kind of hide that stuff till the very end, because that could have disastrous consequences.
Well, it also seems to me that it's assuming that one can control an outcome. And you write something about that, about this fantasy of omnipotence, of controlling other people. And that's also part of the secret, you know, this idea that we control the universe of possibilities with our own thoughts. Something strikes me as so, you know, wonderfully optimistic about that, but also tragic. Well, what do you see?
I mean, I think that that's part of the reason we turn to self-help books. You know, mostly we turn to self-help books in times of helplessness and sometimes desperation. You usually don't read a self-help book when everything is going great in your life. And one of the things that can be scary about a difficult situation is that you really experience this lack of control. You know, relationship ends, you get fired, you've gained a lot of weight, you don't know how to take it off, and you just don't know how to get control of your life. And one thing that self-help books promise you is that you can regain that control. And very often with relationship books, they promise you even more on top of that, which is that you can control the behavior of another person. You know, you can make a man want to marry you, which, if you really think about it, is completely absurd. But I completely understand why that's such an attractive premise.
One of the things that came across to me is that a lot of the advice out there is bunk, and it's given by, you know, sort of run-of-the-mill people who just have a story. But you are very careful to say that people get a lot of relief and comfort and hope out of the experience of self-help in its many forms. How about for you? Did you come away feeling more hopeful about the prospect of self-help?
I did, in a sense. You know, in a very narrow sense. I still think there's a lot out there that is just ridiculous, ridiculous advice. But I think that as intelligent people, we're able to go to the bookstore and kind of weed out those books. And if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is. If something sounds a little crazy, it probably is. But there are a lot of books that make really reasonable promises and that also say, you know, they account for different kinds of experience. A lot of the books I liked on grieving said, you know, grief is really unique. No two people grieve the same way. So, you know, here's a bunch of advice. But if you don't find something useful, feel free to ignore it. And if you do find something useful, use it. So that kind of book, I mean, that approach to me is just so reasonable. It was hard to find anything too wrong with it.
Jessica Lam Shapiro, thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
And that was Jessica Lam Shapiro, author of Promised Land, My Journey Through America's Self-Help Culture. You can find more about her book on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. And while you're there, check out the wonderful array of thank you gifts we're offering for your support during our 3-day March fund drive. Here's how you can help make more programming and less fundraising a reality.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. From kangaroos bred in captivity to trained tigers, exotic pets come from all walks of wildlife. And ownership of wild animals is increasingly becoming a hot debate. Exotic pet owners defend their right to care for critters, from venomous snakes to angry chimps. Animal rights advocates, meanwhile, are doing what they can to stop the purchase of exotic pets and to place current ones into safe, accredited sanctuaries. However, both camps appear to share a love of wild animals. Joining us is Lauren Slater, an animal lover herself, who wrote about the exotic animal ownership debate for National Geographic. Lauren Slater, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you looked into some of the motivations for why people buy and keep exotic pets. What did you find?
I found that there were a couple of different motivations. I mean, the ones that come immediately to my mind are some people buy exotic pets as a sort of status symbol, you know, keeping up with the Joneses type of thing. If the neighbor has, you know, a Bengal cat, then the other person's going to go out and purchase a cougar, you know, just to one-up them sort of thing. And while that sounds strange, that really is a motivation. I mean, there's something exotic and certainly expensive about having, say, a wild cat. But the most common motivation had to do with people falling in love with these animals when they're babies, the mammals especially, like the tigers and the cat, and then taking them home and raising them. The problem, of course, comes in these animals don't stay babies. They grow up and they reach sexual maturity, and then oftentimes problems begin.
Right. They sort of treat them as surrogate children, and eventually, I guess, these children have to be sometime declawed or defanged.
Yeah, and even then, you can declaw, defang, de-whatever your exotic or wild animal, but you can't take its genetic material out of it. And I'm thinking of Michelle Burke, who I interviewed, who had a kinkajou, which is a relatively small animal, wild animal. And the kinkajou's name was Winnie, and she was a beloved family pet. They actually bought her on Craigslist, and they dressed her up in clothes and, you know, anthropomorphized her in all sorts of ways. And then Winnie, at some point, you know, a couple of years down the road, went into her first heat. And she started attacking them and also attacking herself out of just sheer kind of hormonal frustration. Mm. And that was a terrifying experience for the family. This beloved, you know, sweet kinkajou just became a raging monster. And they gave her up after that. So,
well, there are some very gruesome tales of exotic animals turning on their owners. Apparently there's a database. What can you tell us about that, and what kind of things get recorded?
Well, first of all, that database is at Born Free USA, and you can go online and look it up. But the first thing you need to know about that database is it's probably radically incomplete. Born Free USA only reports on reported incidences. It's safe to assume that the vast majority of these incidences go unreported. So obviously Born Free USA has no way of knowing how many, you know, violent incidences actually occur with exotic animals as pets. Mm. You know, again, they report on the ones that make it into the news or the newspaper. And even with that severe limitation on what they can list, there's still, you go on that site and you look at the incidences and it's, you know, someone in Arizona was gutted to death by his kangaroo, you know, by his pet kangaroo. Someone had their hand bitten off by a bear. You know, three venomous snakes were found in the, you know, waiting area of the airport. And it just the list goes on and on.
Wow. Well, what are the current regulations for purchasing and caring for exotic animals?
Well, I think one of the problems with the regulations is that they're not at all consistent from state to state. I live in Massachusetts, and in Massachusetts, it's 100%, it's clear, it's 100% illegal to have any kind of wild animal as a pet. And I think it's the same for New Hampshire. But, for instance, in Ohio, there used to be no regulations on whether or not you could have wild animals. And Ohio, in fact, is full of people who have wild or exotic animals as pets.
Remind us of the story, that gruesome story in Ohio from a couple years ago that set the regulations off.
A man named Jerry Thompson had a menagerie of wild animals on his property. And that actually is not so uncommon. These people who have wild animals as pets will sometimes actually kind of collect them. So he had a large collection of wild animals, tigers, other kinds of large cats, zebras. I mean, it was truly a menagerie. And for whatever reason, and no one really knows what his motivations were, what was going on with him, he let them all loose, you know, 20 or 30 of these wild animals that were living in enclosures on his property in Zanesville, Ohio. Zanesville is not the country, it's a suburb. He let them all loose, and then he killed himself. He shot himself. The sheriff's force had two choices. They could try to dart the animals, basically, you know, shoot them full of medicated darts that would quiet them down and somehow rescue them, or they could just shoot them and kill them. Those darts that you can shoot into animals that quiet them down take a long time to work. And meanwhile, there were people going to work in Zanesville, and the animals were running in front of cars, and there was a good chance they were going to attack, you know, an unsuspecting citizen. So the sheriff's department really felt they had no choice but to slaughter all of the animals to kill them.
So as a result, Ohio's kind of clamping down on the exotic pet ownership. What are they doing?
Well, the first thing I think they did was they made it illegal to have wild animal auctions. I think that happened immediately in the aftermath of Zanesville. And now they are requiring that all wild animal owners register their animals with a central registry and also pay something like $3 to $5 million in insurance to have these animals, which makes it pretty much impossible to have. I mean, not many people can afford to buy insurance like that.
We're speaking with Lauren Slater, who wrote for National Geographic about exotic animal ownership and the debate over whether or not people should be allowed to keep exotic animals. Lauren, you write in your article that it is believed that more exotic animals live in American homes than are cared for in American zoos. So what is the case that wild animal owners make for why they should be allowed to keep these animals?
Well, there's a group called REXANO, which stands for Responsible Exotic Animal Ownership. The case that they make and the case that other people who own these exotic animals would make is that, number one, the number of violent incidences that happen with these exotic animals is actually lower than the number of violent incidences that happen with domestic animals. So if you go on Born Free USA's website and you look at their incidences of wild animal attacks on human beings, you'll find, you know, hundreds of incidences listed there. But there are more incidences of people visiting the ER for, say, dog bites. The other argument that they make is that it's, you know, it's within their rights as, you know, a United States citizen to own these animals, and restricting them from owning them is in interfering with their, you know, personal freedom that comes with being a citizen of the United States. And a third argument would be that wild animals have been kept by humans and human civilizations for as long as civilization has been around, which is about 12 or 13,000 years, and probably even before civilizations were actually constructed, people probably kept wild animals as pets, so that there's a long history to this. You know, but again, it comes back to the baseline argument, is that it's no more or less safe or unsafe than having a dog or a cat.
How about the argument against wild animal ownership made by animal rights activists?
Well, there's a lot of arguments, but I think the first one is that there is a big difference between a domesticated and a wild animal. Of all of the large land mammals that roam this earth, and there are, you know, hundreds, only 13 of them, I think, have been successfully domesticated over thousands and thousands of years. To domesticate an animal takes thousands and thousands of years of culling from the gene pool and selective breeding. So a domesticated animal has a different genome from a wild animal. And when you take a wild animal and put it into a domestic situation, its natural inclinations, its very genetic structure does not mesh with a domestic situation. In other words, it's meant to be a wild animal. It's not meant to live in captivity. It's not going to flourish in captivity, and therefore presents dangers in captivity to both the owner and to the animal. For instance, when that, you know, a couple of years ago, I'm sure some of your listeners or maybe all of them heard of the terrible incident with the chimpanzee in Connecticut.
Oh, right. He mauled a woman's face.
Terribly mauled a woman. Now, that chimpanzee, you know, needed to be killed. So, you know, it came to a terrible, terrible end for both the chimpanzee primate and the human primate. Both were, one was killed and one was irrevocably mauled. So, you know, these are some of the arguments against it. It's not good for humans and it's not good for animals. Wild animals are meant to live in the wild. They are not meant to live in captivity.
Lauren Slater, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Lauren Slater is author of The $60,000 Dog, My Life with Animals. She spoke with us earlier when her article for National Geographic called Wild Obsession first came out. And NHPR is trying something a little wild for our March fun drive. We're shortening it by an entire week. That's right, just 3 days instead of the usual 10 to ensure that you get more programming and less fundraising. So your help to keep us on track is more important than ever. Here's how.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jason Bogue loves books. As a toddler, he was a frequent visitor at the local library in Lyons, Michigan. He continued reading and writing his way to a journalism degree at NYU, spent 5 years as the publishing editor for Media Bistro, where he covered books and publishing. Then he became a dad. Jason and his wife wanted their daughter, Olive, to love books, but knew she'd be born into a world full of screens and digital devices. So Jason wrote a book. He talked to doctors and authorities on child development, education, and literature to get the latest advice on encouraging today's kids to read. The result is Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age.
It's really simple. Parents can learn it in about an hour. It's basically when you're reading a book to a child, you really have to make it an interactive experience for them. You need to ask questions about the colors, about the feelings that the characters are having. And if you have a child that's not even ready to talk about these things, you can point and you can help them interact with the text itself. That interaction is one of the most important things you can do for a growing child's brain.
Well, there are 15 points to this interactive reading, and we can't go through all of them individually, so we'll just kind of use that as a lens for this entire conversation. First, when do you start reading to a kid?
I tell people that those first couple weeks, just do it. I mean, reading is a set of motions. We all think that we were kind of readers, that it's in our blood or something like that, but it's not. It's a set of motions that you were taught by your parents or the caregivers, the people that cared to share books with you. Earlier this, about a month ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics actually put out recommendations telling pediatricians to start informing parents of this very fact, that you should just be reading from infancy onward with your child.
And you write that kids can interact with books at 6 months. Interact? Really? How?
This is actually the very first piece of evidence I collected myself for the book. I had been reading to my daughter this book called Lost and Found, and I had been reading that book to my daughter for a few months, and she just sits there. I don't know how many people in the audience have experience with newborns. They just sit there. They don't do anything. They're very mute. But I could see her eyes following it, and about 6 months in, I had been reading this book for a while, and the penguin, there's this triumphant moment when he comes back, and every time I would be interactive, I would highlight that moment with expressive motions, and it was magical. She lit up and she actually squealed for joy. It was the first reaction I had ever seen her have to a piece of text, and it was for me the very first moment that she grasped how a story worked.
You speak to others who've done other research. John Protzko at NYU wrote about how to make kids smarter. Some data from Dr. Grover Whitehurst, who came up with this idea of interactive reading after studying 21 to 35-month-olds. You write about giving kids a leg up by teaching them to read. Any factual data or numbers you can share with us that illustrate that point?
Yeah, the NYU study you mentioned by Protzko, that was the one that really turned me on to this. They looked at about 6 to 8 different studies of child development and found that reading to a child can quantitatively raise their IQ by 6 points. Seeing that number really kind of blew my mind. I mean, in some ways, it is common sense. I mean, we know that reading is helpful and that people that have been reading books, it makes them smarter. But the cognitive gains that happen that early in a child's life, I think it's really important. You can't reiterate it enough that reading really is important. Changing your child's brain, making them smarter, and also just making them more emotionally healthy as they're learning how to explain their feelings and how to actually control those feelings.
Now, you encourage parents to carefully consider how and when they introduce digital devices to kids. We've heard the argument that devices are more interactive than paper books and therefore healthier than watching television, for example. How do digital books and devices fit into this idea of interactive reading?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that word interactive lately. If you look at any app store right now, you'll see that word interactive batted around many, many times. And there's two senses of the word interactive. There's one, the sense of a device that can interact with its user. The other, more profound meaning for me, is an interaction between two people, and that's what interactive reading means. It's when a human being is talking to another human being. And it turns out, I spoke to neuroscientists about that, it turns out that for a growing brain, the only thing that will help that brain grow, that will carve new neural pathways in the brain, is the human voice. You could have one of these devices reading a book to you, but it would not have the same impact that you see when a human is reading that same book to them.
How do you encourage your kids to read books in an age dominated by screens? Jason Bogue is with us. We've spoken to him many times when he led the Galley Cat blog. Now he's out with a new practical guide to encouraging kids to develop a lifelong love of reading. It's called Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age. Do we have enough data now on when to introduce digital devices to kids? And what did you come away with? Any suggestions?
Yeah, I still, the child development community does not have enough data to conclusively say this is the correct amount of time to spend. I go back to the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations that were issued a few years ago. I still believe them. I still think they're important. It says no or minimalize screen time before 2 years old. And after that, I wouldn't do more than an hour a day. It's tough. It's not going to make your life easier. These devices are tremendous. Powerful babysitters. And I encourage parents to try to do the same thing and just to really be mindful how much time you're spending on these devices. And the other really, really important thing that numerous experts told me is no devices at bedtime. Let your child know that bedtime is when we read books or when we tell each other stories, but those screens are tremendously disruptive to sleep patterns and just your calming down process.
Well, I imagine that one of the well-thumbed pages in the book will be page 64, How to Avoid Using Devices. Some tactics. But one of the things I enjoyed about the book is that you do know that kids are going to be drawn to apps. They're going to be drawn to electronic books, to television, to other media. So one of the tactics you use is a kind of reading bundle. I'd like to unpack one of those reading bundles now. Here's something to lead us into that may sound very familiar to listeners.
Lemon, don't let them sleep. Be a good girl. You always have to be. Let it go. Let it go.
That's a four-year-old from Brooklyn singing Let It Go, the song from Frozen that is just on just about any kid's lips. So let's explore this idea. Just about every kid in America knows the words to that song. What are some suggestions for launching off of that passion into books?
Yeah, well, Virginia, I first of all, I'm kind of hurt. You should have just asked me to sing that song. I'm perfectly capable of singing it. You don't need to bring on four-year-olds.
You might not be as instantly cute.
No, we sing that song all the time in my house, and it was one of those things. I mean, it comes into your house as an audiovisual thing. It's a movie, and you want to limit that time that she spends watching movies, and But she had such enthusiasm for it. And over and over and over, the experts told me the only way children learn is when they're chasing the things that they're interested in. So I looked at this. I said, here's something she's really interested in. What can we do to expand upon that? So I went to the bookstore, and Random House has published tons of Frozen spin-off books. The one that I recommend, after looking at many, many of them, the Frozen Big Golden Book is really the most satisfying out of all of those. It's a way of revisiting a movie and kind of having an interactive reading experience going through the story again on the page. And then after that, you can use, and I started to do this with Olive, there's a number of apps that actually let your child tell a story. My Story, Felt Board, Draw and Tell, Toontastic, these are all really powerful tools for letting your child tell stories with simple digital puppets, simple digital tools that they can draw with. And you can say, hey, I know you love the story of Elsa and Anna. What happens next? And they can actually draw it. Or if they can't draw, they can use these little puppets and make voices and record themselves making the sequel to Frozen and continuing that story. It's really cool to watch them learn storytelling that way. And then the thing I've been reminding parents is it's based on Hans Christian Andersen's The Snow Queen, which is a really great fairy tale that I hadn't read in many, many, many years. There's a lot of amazing stuff going on in that story. I found an old-time radio drama adaptation of it, like a 1930s kids show that adapted it. It was really fun. Olive and I spent time listening to that in the car. And then The Great Chukowski did an adaptation as well, and I found that adaptation with a Russian ballerina reading the story, and Olive was enraptured by the whole thing. And Olive and I sat in the car and spent many hours discussing how love can thaw the frozen heart, which is the message of both Hans Christian Andersen's story and Frozen as well.
That makes it so exciting, and I guess feel a little bit less like, brain candy to watch a Disney film. But I do read a lot of dispiriting statistics on kids raised in households that don't read or are very verbal. Is this interactive reading model something that public education, not just parents, can take up?
I really feel it's a public health issue, exactly what you've just described. I feel like we should be treating those statistics as something as troubling as malnutrition. I mean, it's really an important part of brain growth for children. And just because these techniques take about an hour to learn, and they were tested in communities where there weren't a lot of resources, and it's easy for anyone to learn it. So I was really encouraged that the American Academy of Pediatrics is now telling doctors to remind parents that this is important. But I really think it should be a policy push. We really should just be making sure that parents have this information when they leave the hospital.
Okay, so with the pack of disposable diapers, Born Reading by Jason Bogue in every Bring It On Home kit, huh?
Well, it doesn't have to be my book. I would think there's plenty, and I stress this on my website as well. Like, if someone it doesn't have the resources to reach out for my book, there are plenty of free resources to learn the art of interactive reading online too. Plenty of things you can print off, put on your refrigerator. I feel this is so important, and whatever we can do to spread the message to parents is valuable.
Well, Jason, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for being with us again.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I love being on the show. Thank you.
And that's our earlier conversation with Jason Bogue, director of story investigation at True Pictures. He's author of the book Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age. Take a moment to think about all the books you've read or have learned about by listening to NHPR. Whether it is an in-depth author interview with Terry Gross or Maureen Corrigan's book reviews, public radio values arts and culture and knows you do as well. Here's your chance to support the programming that you rely on. Just give us a call.